We'll go along to the final Wise Men Seer podcast of the season, and that is going to be it for summer. We're going to have a summer off, Gareth, aren't we?
It'd be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah. To not have to do anything for a bit.
Can't wait for it. I could do with a night off, to be honest.
Why is that?
Bit of a heavy one.
Was it?
So we brought in a couple of people who like to speak for the last one, and hopefully I can just sit indoors off for a bit. Nick Barnes, Sunderland commentator. Been a while since you've been on, Nick, I think.
It is. And I'm just thinking, I think Sunderland have had a season off, haven't they?
Yeah.
It feels like about eight.
And Martin McFadden from Love Supreme joins us as well.
Hiya, how are you doing?
Fresh from doing loads of interviews. There's always something happened whenever you seem to be on, because we always sit and say this to you.
There's always something happening, isn't there? Although, yeah. Actually, listening to your crack in the car on the way here, it sounds like you've been busier than me, socially.
Wait,
anyway. In terms of alcohol consumption.
You had some crack in the car? It doesn't sound...
He was making us laugh and everything.
Really? Yeah.
It's never been known. Right.
Who wants to say
things about Sunderland, because I haven't got anything prepared for
it. Keep on seeing Martin on the telly.
No, sorry about that.
It's okay, mate. Martin, you said it was a bit of an anti-climax in the end of the season, really, in a way.
Well, the Chelsea game in itself, it was almost like a kind of...
non-event.
Yeah, like a show. You know, when they carried Drogba off after, like, 29 minutes, I was like, oh, well, maybe they're not trying as hard as they might be.
It was like going to the West End, wasn't it? It was like being on the tourist trail, and what you do when you come to London, because it all seemed to be foreign accents around the stadium, is you buy a ticket to go and watch a show at Stamford Bridge, and that was all part of it.
Mm. A lot of flag waving.
Very odd.
It was nice to go into the last game, like, with their...
Pressure off.
Yeah, and just to kind of try and enjoy to see who was going to go down between Newcastle and Hull, but I hadn't really reckoned for the Mags... like ending up higher in the league than us, to be honest with you. I hadn't even considered that scenario.
I wouldn't have liked to have gone into the last game, though, needing something the way it panned out at Chelsea.
Yeah.
Just that atmosphere and the way the game was and the way that Jose Mourinho and Chelsea sort of stage managed the occasion. I just felt that would have been a horrible game for Sunderland to have to go in needing a point.
Mm. But, I mean,
definitely.
Application of the players was quite good again, do we think? The Sunderland players didn't seem like had nothing to play for, maybe, which is a little bit worrying because Chelsea didn't even seem to get it with second gear, and
they
still beat us quite comfortably.
Like, Mignone should have done better for the second and the
third. I haven't seen them back on the telly yet, but the second one from where I was sitting,
bad, and the third one is positioning that don't really know what he's doing.
Is he on his way out now, Nick?
Yeah.
I think
Mignone's time has come. I think regardless of whoever was going to come in or does come in or if Dick stays, I think the fact that he's not really had a look in all season really since the start, if I was Mignone as well, and that Pantelimon is going to be the number one keeper, and the clubs that Mignone's been at, Arsenal and Sunderland, he won't want to be sitting another season on the bench. So regardless of whether they think he's good enough or not, I think it'd have been agitating to move anyway.
We were talking about this the other night, and he could move somewhere else and then end up being second choice as well, even if they take him in as, and then the same way you're going to be the first. It's always the same with keepers, isn't it? They're a weird lot where you think they must be sick by now, but some keepers always seem to be second choice everywhere,
and sadly, I mean, he's a lovely guy. You couldn't fault him in that aspect, but... one of the problems is his mental fragility, I think. I think we saw that towards those few games when he was sort of left in by Gus. And to a degree, it was there at Stamford Bridge on Sunday as well. And I think, any manager or any goalkeeping coach looks at Mignone mentally and thinks, actually, is he strong enough to be number one at a club? If you're going to play at that higher level. I mean, I could see him playing in the Championship and being a number one keeper in the Championship, but I think he's got... ambitions beyond that, and that's possibly what's going to hold him back.
You feel, because we were a little bit concerned when we signed him, and then he actually got player of the season, didn't
he? Yeah.
But despite that, you always feel like there's a blunder there waiting, don't you? There's one around the corner.
Yeah, he's made
might be a bit harsh, but at the top level, I guess that's it.
I think last season everyone obviously loved him, and then this season Pantelimon has kind of showed that he's like a cut above. I think his only weakness is that, like, one-on-one strikers know that if they hit a low, he's not going to get down to us,
Although, he did get low down against Leicester, didn't he? Was it? Well, a couple of games, he did actually show himself to be quite agile.
There's been a few I feel that he's given goals away that, like, a smaller keeper would have gotten to them. But then, obviously, when he comes for crosses, sort of Mart Poom-like, and you see the attackers just like looking round as if to say we're not going to get anything in the air.
Never felt as secure being a Sunderland fan when the other team gets corners and puts the balls into the box. He just comes and clears it.
We're quite a tall team as well now, which is something that Poyet was sort of like looking towards sorting. Where, you know, when we used to have Gardner, Larson, Catamol, we used to have like a short ass midfield, really, didn't we? And now we've got players around the pitch who are actually, you know, quite tall. You get a few extra players like Rodwell, and you know, like even some of the wingers are actually quite tall. It counts on set pieces.
I mean, going back to Mignone as well, we forget sometimes. You know, you go back to last season and that blunder at Manchester City, and you know what a huge one that was, really, in some senses.
You felt
you did, but I think season. It was sort of indicative of where Mignone is mentally sometimes.
I think you look over the years at Sunderland, and we've had, like, every season we seem to have had one decent keeper, and I mean, before Mignolet had his unbelievable year and got his move to Liverpool, it was very much a toss-up between Westwood and Mignolet. That it was who's going to get the start, and it was Mignolet in the end. I mean, Westwood, I know he started under Di Canio, and he actually, I remember, I know we got beat 3-1 or whatever it was off Arsenal, but he in the first half, he was just making save after save. He had about 7 or 8 shots to make save, and then he was doing all right until he got, I think he got his head taken off by Paul McShane in that game at Hull, where we ended up with 9 men.
But it's a tough position in the sense, I think it's changed over the years. I mean,
Westwood's also got player of the season at Sheffield Wednesday.
That doesn't surprise. I mean, he's a solid keeper in a lot of ways, but you go back and you look at the way that goalkeeping's changed over the last 10 years, because ball technology's changed as well. I mean, even the likes of Joe Hart aren't, you know, they're susceptible to being dropped. They're not consistent. You don't get many keepers right through the league from top to bottom who are consistent, perhaps like they were 20 years ago.
I think we've done all right for keepers over the last sort of 12-15 years. We always keep the keepers busy though, don't we? You know, so
the only bad season.
Is he going to get a move, or do we have to worry about that now?
I think you definitely get a move.
You're a risk when you're a club like Sunderland, aren't you?
We need to bring somebody else in.
Losing those players. Because if we think now Mignone is going to leave and Pickford might step up, he's probably
There's a very, very strong chance Pickford he'll be number 2 next season.
Yeah, so he's not. But you wouldn't say he was quite ready for number 1. So it's important.
No, but I think, I mean, it's the old argument that you know, I mean, it's the Duncan Watmore argument to a degree, isn't it? That if you've got a talent like that, the only way they're going to get experience is by putting them in the first team. It's harder for Pickford if he does step up to number 2 next season, because he's unlikely to get the chance, because Pantelimon is, you know, is pretty much solid.
Traditionally, the number 2 keeper plays in the League Cup. So he might get his go in the Cup, which
that might be quite good
for him. We lose 3-1 at home to Crewe or something, and somebody will score from like 25 yards for Crewe, won't they?
Well, it's Stranger Things. I mean, keepers, I think, always work on the basis as well that somewhere down the line, the first choice does get an injury or does get, you know, something happens and there is a switch.
I think we've got, I mean, the season, I think it was the most frustrating one was probably when we had Poom and Myra, and we went up and then got rid of them and got Kelvin Davis, and we had Ben Anik for that season when we got 15 points, which was probably the weakest pair of goalkeepers we've had in the last 10
Davis
years.
But Davis then had a solid career at Southampton, and as it turned out, played against Sunderland.
Yeah.
I remember bumping into Tim Carter, like, sort of rest his soul, on that pre-season when we got Davis in, and him and Nosworthy kept running into each other and losing, and that was just before the season started. But I was like, we had two good keepers, and he's kind of got rid of them both. And he was like, McCarthy felt we had injury problems, and it was just really strange, because he didn't have much money to spend, and he spent quite a lot of money on him from what we had. And then obviously just didn't work. But then, like you say, he was playing at the weekend still, like in the Premiership.
Mm. I'll never forget that night at Old Trafford, though, when Davis had that blinder. Yeah, I mean, it was one good game. But, I mean, if you're going to have a good game, what a good game to have.
I think the thing with keepers is...
Yeah. The league, that,
I think the thing with it keepers did, yeah, is, yeah. like, once you don't trust them, you never feel safe with them, you know, and it's the same with centre-halves. I mean, in a way...
Yeah, but I think Mignone suffered from that as well. Yeah, I think he knows that.
Man City,
I think he knew straight away that when
he
made the mistakes... I think that the issue with Mignone and Pantelimon was Mignone was undermined to a certain extent in the summer when Pantelimon was signed, because suddenly Mignone felt then, hang on a minute, if he's brought in Pantelimon, he doesn't want me as number one. So every save I make from the start of the season if I get the shirt, which he had to get, really, he's under scrutiny. So he knows that they were waiting for that mistake. Mm. And then he makes a mistake. And what does Gus come out and say? Well, I don't drop a keeper after one game. I do it after two. And that's what, you know, you could see him then in that game. He was a bag of nerves just waiting to make that mistake.
The Arsenal game, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Davis talks about it a lot now, doesn't he, saying that it got to a point where the Sunderland fans just blamed him for everything that went in, and that's possibly true, because he said it's hard to get that reputation off, but I think Matt Taylor scored from Roker or something against him.
Yeah, he did, yeah. It was Portsmouth, he was playing for Portsmouth, wasn't it?
Mm, halfway line, wasn't scored it? From the beach or something.
Someone ran on the pitch, didn't they?
Yeah, the confront.
Weren't we like losing 4-0 before half-time or something?
No, 1-0 up at half-time.
1-0 up at half-time, but lost 4-1
or second, we did that twice that season, so well, the other one, we're not talking about the other one. It's a good job he played well, and we got that point on the Good Friday, because it would have been a rather unpleasant experience.
But the goalkeeping position's a horrible one anyway. I mean, you're talking about centre-halves, I mean, and making mistakes. I mean, Brown, you know, for all that he is a solid centre-half, you know that in a season there'll be 2-3 games where he drops a clanger. But a centre-half, the outfield players will get away with it.
Yeah,
you know, they will.
Sure.
They're not as scrutinised as a goalkeeper.
Definitely. We mentioned the 15-point team now. We mention them far too much, don't we? I'm trying to like erase that from my memory.
It's
but
the history makers.
Well, but as far as, you know,
beat themselves.
As far as
19 points,
they're legends.
15.
As far as rubbish Sunderland performances go, Nick, all the years you've been covering them, the 8-0 at Southampton this season.
Yeah, it was the worst
I've seen.
I mean, the strange thing was that that afternoon was really weird, because all the build-up in the weeks to that Southampton game had been about the crisis at Newcastle. They were in absolute disarray. And then, of course, that afternoon was the afternoon that Newcastle were unveiling that huge screen. And a couple of hours before kick-off, it turns out it's hanging off, you know, and they couldn't open the ground. And so everything was focused on St James's Park, and it was a metaphor for everything that was going on at Newcastle. And then the Southampton game kicks off, because everything was serendipity at Sunderland at that point. You know, pretty good start to the season, draw at West Brom, blah, blah, blah. And then Virginie scores that wonder goal. And
it's class, isn't it?
It was absolutely unbelievable.
You had to rub your eyes with that one.
Well, it was.
Yeah, that
then,
was like,
and
did that really just happen?
You couldn't really be angry at him, could you?
They go 2 up.
I was celebrating.
Oh, it was just extraordinary. Watching that was just extraordinary, because it was such a fantastic finish at the wrong end.
And then they heard you commentate on that goal, actually.
I wonder
what it was like.
I think he was confused by not wearing red and white stripes, wasn't it, that afternoon?
Funnily enough, we actually played all right that game at first.
Well, they did, Southampton went 2-0 up, but then there's the penalty incident, or the penalty that wasn't given, which should have been given.
The red card as well.
Which should have been a red card. And you're thinking, going into half-time, 2-0, OK, they've played all right. They've had a bad decision against them. But then, there's this curious switch at half-time, Bridcut coming in and playing at right-back, Brown taken off, and there was nothing wrong with him. And you just got a sense that the senior pros came out thinking, what's Poyet playing at here? And I would never accuse the players of downing tools, but there seemed to be an element of the senior players thinking, you know, sod this, I'm not going to turn up
for the
second half.
There was one goal that we conceded where, from the kick-off, they just scored, and I think Cattermole got the ball and give it away, and then they scored immediately afterwards. Yeah. Then it was like, it was one of those errors that you don't make.
But it got worse and worse. I mean, it got to the point where 20 minutes from the end, and they were 6-0 up or whatever it was, and you just watched Southampton. They left 5 players up in the Sunderland half. They were so confident that Sunderland couldn't do them any harm whatsoever down the other end. They just left everybody up and then started basically bullying Sunderland with pace and physicality. And is it Tadic on the right just had a field day, and then Bridcut was being sort of torn apart down the left. And it was just, I mean, with 10 minutes to go, it was 8-0. And you're sitting thinking, this is going to finish 11 or 12, because they can easily score another 3 or 4 in the time that's left.
God. Why can we not be the team that does that to other sides?
Well, we did once in the late 90s. We did that to teams every week. It was
an Oxford or somebody. We beat 7-0, didn't we? That was a good game.
7.
The weird thing about that Southampton game, although we are going to sort of dwell on some of the positive aspects of the season, was that before then, I was thinking, oh, we're going to be like solid at the back, and we're going to have like lots of goalless draws. Although, ironically,
going into the game,
you know?
It was all talk about that Southampton and Sunderland had the two best defensive records in the Premier League.
I mean, Sunderland, it is an anomaly. You look at it, if you, I know you can't remove games, but if you took that 8-0, the 4-1 at home at Palace, and the 4-0
Villa,
the Villa, and also teams sometimes do get beat 4, but it was the manner of the three defeats. That's 16 goals.
You know, I had to do a piece with Radio Leicester in the build up to the Leicester game, and we're talking about the season. And I said, yeah, exactly that point. You take those three games out, the 16 goals. And the guy from Leicester went, well, you can't, that happened.
Yeah, exactly. It was the manner of that was alarming. And that happened not just under Poy, it happened obviously under Advocaat as well in that one game. So, but, you know, as well, it's just an anomaly, isn't it? Those games, the fact that we only lost 14 games this season.
Yeah, 17 draws, 14 defeats. I mean, 14 defeats would take you into the top half of the table, and if you could convert some of those draws at Leicester, Burnley, should have probably got something at Queen's Park Rangers, you know, it starts to nudge up the points tally. And so, in a way, there's a sort of aberration, isn't there, in February, March, when Gus started to sort of think, right, this isn't for me. And I mean, that Aston Villa game, I still insist, I think he engineered that. I think he was quite happy when they started conceding goals in the first half to let it happen. It suited him for Sunderland to get heavily beaten because he wanted to get the sack. And then, you know, he rubber stamped it with the decision to bring to keep Larson on and bring him out late for the second half. I mean, all those things indicative to me that he was determined then to go. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't going to resign, but he gets his payoff. So he made sure that, you know, he got paid off because he'd run his course at the club.
Do you believe there was anything behind the rumours of him trying to kind of engineer a job elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I've been told on good authority he wanted the Palace job, and he'd also been interested in the West Ham job.
Mm.
So the feelers were out. He was looking for a way out. I think the Queen's Park Rangers game and the Aston Villa game were just sort of, to me, they were glaringly two games where he... I mean, the Queen's Park Rangers game that first half, he sat on the bench, didn't come out and try and change anything.
When the whole stadium could see that the problems were coming down one side.
Exactly. We knew that problem was there at Swansea. You know, Benno highlighted that at Swansea time and time again, that Swansea were exploiting the right-hand wing, and that happened again against Queen's Park Rangers, and he did nothing to change it.
That was, I mean, because I always liked Gus, and I was always behind him. And we've said before that, you know, obviously standing down with you after that QPR game was the time when listening to Gus at the end of the game was when I started to think, I think you're losing the plot here a little bit, mate. Was when he was starting to have a go about the players and the fans' reaction to, like, well, what was a spirited second half performance.
Yeah,
and
he did, didn't he? He had a go at the club.
There's nothing great tactical thinking behind it. It was just the players would put more effort in. That's all it seemed like. And he seemed to sort of take exception.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, Gus is a person. You know, he's charismatic. I like him. And, you know, he's a very personable person, if that makes sense. but he's very bright as well. He's intelligent. I mean, it's interesting that when he was appointed, a few people at Brighton and elsewhere in football said, look, he is bright, he is intelligent, but there is a slight Paolo Di Canio madness in him. And that was, I think, you know, now with hindsight, we're hearing, it was manifesting itself in falling out with a lot of the coaching staff at the Academy of Light, and you know, relationships with Ellis Short were broken down previously the previous summer, and relationships with a lot of staff were breaking down. And so that, you know, that's not the way forward. You're not going to get anywhere if your head coach is in those sort of, that dynamic is happening. And I think he realised then that, you know, it just wasn't going to pan out for him, wasn't going to work.
And when it didn't, and Dick Advocaat come in, Gareth's touched on the Palace performance there. How it was, you know, similar to the other sort of way that the side have collapsed this season. And what's impressed me most about Advocaat, as simplistic as it sounds, is the attitude of the players, that I see that being down to him, his influence. And it's worth noting, isn't it, that because the players down till in that Palace game, we saw that we still then got a positive reaction quite quickly after
Dick
that.
Dick was adamant because I said to him it reminded me of the Southampton game in the way that in the second half I thought Palace bullied Sunderland's defenders with pace and aggression. But he was straight in there, and Bert, to say, no, I absolutely fundamentally disagree. The problems against Palace were nothing to do with being bullied, nothing to do with pace. It was all to do because they played a long ball over the top and they couldn't cope with that defensively, and refused to panic and refused to be drawn into an issue about the players. And he said, it's a one-off. I mean, he was clear in his own mind. and definitely kept on saying it's a one-off. I know what the problems were. It's a fundamental technical problem. It's nothing to do with attitude or confidence. And to his credit, he's always had that sort of benign calm about him through these games. He's never got angry. He's never sort of got to a point where he's slamming players. He's always been very, very diligently protecting every thing. He'll talk about the team and what the team should do as a whole, but he won't sort of take one player out and single them out.
I think that's what you get with a more experienced manager, though, don't you? You know, they went for experience with O'Neill and then obviously decided that he wasn't in at work enough days a week, or his plan wasn't working without John Robertson. So they went for like a young, hungry, insane manager, and then a young, hungry, slightly less insane. But with like sort of Latin Americans and sort of Mediterraneans, you get that passion and that people loved in Tecanio. But then when it all goes wrong, they spit the dummy out as well. And then we've kind of gone back to Advocaat, and I think, it's been lucky, but it's been a really good appointment as well. And he hasn't really got. He wanted to play that system that he's always played, the 4-3-3, you could call it, or whatever you know you want to call it, but he didn't really have the place to play that system, especially, you know, like I thought Defoe was kind of in the wrong position, you know, but he's obviously, he needs a big man in the middle to make those three work. And it was quite attacking. And I think it's pretty amazing that we weren't exposed more with the players that we've actually got.
And you mentioned Defoe there, and
you're giving a lot of room down the channels, for people to attack us, and the fullbacks are bombing forward, and you're playing three up front.
And when he signed Jermaine Defoe, it was a head-scratcher straight away for a lot of us, because we thought, well, Poyet likes to play a one up front. Now, you've just pointed out yourself there that Defoe isn't really suited to being that man. So we all thought,
well, that was Gus said, didn't he? Yeah. I'm going to have to change the system.
Exactly. Then we thought, well, this is you know, going against the grain of what Poyet normally does here. And that's kind of really when he lost his way, didn't he?
It did, because he just didn't know where to turn. He didn't know how to address that problem.
I mean, at Hull, that point actually probably kept us up, hasn't
it?
Because it would have been a couple of points
exactly.
A couple less for us. And
well, it seems a bit ironic, I think, as well, that Sunderland stayed up with a 0-0 draw. It's a sort of indicative of the way the season went, you know, the 17 draws, they were going to stay up with a draw.
If you drew every game, you'd end up with 38 points. Yeah.
His two team selections in the last two Hull away games were probably like his worst, weren't they? You know,
I couldn't believe what I was saying in the cup. And he had four centre midfielders, and it's the worst I've seen Sunderland play in years.
Jack Rodwell, interestingly enough, came out afterwards and said they didn't understand the players at half-time, why they were playing in the positions they were playing, which is unusual for players to come out after a game and criticise a coach. But Rodwell came out and said, I was playing out wide, and I don't know why. I've never played there before.
And of course, after the game, Poyet said, I didn't think we played that bad.
Yeah,
the only sense I could make of it was like in a relegation battle. You know, Dennis Smith used to sometimes play a bit like that, where he played like a lot of, he'd have like Armstrong and Owers on the wing, who were like central players, or he even had Hardiman. I know this is going a long way back for some of the listeners, but Hardiman, who was a left back, he'd play him like left wing away from home. So he had like a solid midfield. So if he won the battle, and then he'd introduce more creative players as the match went on. And that's how we got our goal, you know, by bringing on, if you're not in the game with 20 minutes to go, you can't bring on attacking players, you know, but he got away with it then, but it was a really strange selection. But so was the one away at Hull last year in the cup. You know, he did some weird things, Poyet. There's no doubt about it.
I mean, you just mentioned bringing players on. It's extraordinary that Sunderland went through the whole season and not one substitute scored a goal this season.
But last year,
nobody changed a game.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at his substitutions last year, like the work like amazingly well.
We used to credit them for his substitutions
real
time.
Habit. But I suppose you've got to have the players on the bench. You know, like you've got to say the likes of Alvarez and Jacquarini haven't done anything this season. You know, the type of players you would have on the bench. We haven't really had a striker.
But it's just the whole thing. It's just reflective of how strange I find it all, because we used to credit Poyet for his substitutions. We used to say he's got a plan B, he's got a plan C, he's got a plan D. Yet by the end,
he didn't have a plan A.
There was just nothing, was there?
I think the problem was that he was on to plan X, Y, and Z, and he'd gone through them all in the space of about 10 games.
Coming back to the point Martin made as well about Martin O'Neill not having John Robertson. You know, Gus Poyet had Charlie Oakway and Tano as his assistants. But I think it's interesting that Dick Advocaat has got Bert there. He's been with him 30 years.
Yeah.
And there's something, I think sometimes we don't give enough credit to number twos and how important a role they play with a manager. And I think, you know, that was another weakness of Paolo Di Canio. It was all about him. Mm. He didn't have anybody to stand up to him. Roy Keane didn't have anybody alongside of him to stand up to him. Martin O'Neill lost John Robertson. Dick Advocaat now has got someone, you know, who's been there with him through it all, which I think is quite interesting.
You could even argue that, like Brian Clough, once Peter Taylor and him fell out, he didn't really achieve anything. He didn't really win anything, you know.
And I think, you know, they do sort of underestimate the importance of number two.
It would be interesting if you could speak to some of the coaching staff on the Martin O'Neill to see how much of a difference the Robertson thing, you know, what difference it did make, because that's the only thing you can really
I think Martin O'Neill himself
must have been a problem.
Missed him. I mean, the way he used to talk about John Robertson and, you know, still kept in contact with him, and I think he was quite wistful about the fact that he couldn't have him alongside of him.
But then imagine if we'd never sacked O'Neill, like what position would we be in now? Would we have actually like built on things with stability? Would we have gone down that year? I don't think we would have, you know.
Gareth would be happy because then Alfred and Dye would still be here.
Possibly, yeah.
Sorry to bring the name up.
I don't know if you're over it now. I'm over it now. It's fine.
I mean, there are a lot of people who you talk to who agree with you, think that had Martin O'Neill stayed, they would have got the two wins.
I don't think they would have.
You see, but a lot of people do.
We'll never know.
There was one argument as well that season, you know, if Wigan hadn't had the FA Cup final, you know, Wigan probably would have stayed up and Sunderland probably would have gone down.
But even if we'd gone down and kept them and come back up again, I mean, you know, we were saying when I was doing something with Martin Emerson the day that Poy had got sacked, we were saying, like, if you look back, if you ask people these days, you know, who was the best Sunderland manager in your time supporting the club, they'd probably say Peter Reid because he was here the longest. You know, he got us relegated twice, but then he obviously brought us back up and he brought us success. We finished, we had those two seasons, we were top of the league once, for God's sake. But in this day and age, he would have got sacked after the first relegation. Yeah. Mm. And if he wouldn't have got sacked, then he would have got sacked after we lost 4-1 away to Reading and fans were outside throwing things at the players when they got on the bus. So he never would have signed Kevin Phillips. You know, he never would have had time to come back for that Charlton playoff. We never walked the league the next year. You know, we never would have had time to build. But I know the game has changed now, but I think that what they need to do now is get a manager, hopefully Advocaat, give him some money, and give him the time. And when things go a little bit wrong next year, if they do, don't just sack the manager straight away. I think that's Ellis Short's weakness because he's not a football person. I'm sure he's picking up things along the way, but I think too often now in football, and especially at Sunderland, we just sack the manager as a knee jerk.
Well, is it every 18 months, isn't it? Well, it is too much of a knee
jerk.
They could look at it now and think it's worked, couldn't they?
Well, there is.
Well, it depends what your ambition is.
Is that it hasn't worked because they know that you can't every season end up in a relegation battle. And eventually you will get relegated. And I think the Dick Advocaat thing is interesting. If he says yes, you know, you will get, I think, a good manager for 2 years because that's what they've offered him. And I'm assuming he will. If he says yes, he's going to stay the 2 years.
And he's going to win money, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's got to have, though, then some way in which you bring on the next person, and the next appointment's got to be massive, because if Dick now doesn't say yes, they're in a horrible situation where they've got to appoint somewhere, whereas Martin says they look for stability and consistency.
And their original choice
to be
has
here
now
3, 4, 5 years.
The original choice has now gone elsewhere.
He's gone elsewhere. But I think that there was a shift in the club's view of who they were going to appoint from Clement, because with Dick Advocaat coming in and seeing what he's done, I think they've shifted now to realising what they need is someone who's experienced.
I think we all have.
The point you made about O'Neill is fair, but I think the issue there was they were sleepwalking. Like Peter Reid, I'd say, I think you're right. I think now he probably would be sacked because people were calling for his head and whatnot. But what you can see on the pitch is that there was some level of evolution there, because he did things a certain way to keep us up, then a certain way to get us promoted.
But it shows that sometimes getting relegated isn't like the end of the world.
Well, I think Norwich were, I think, unlucky probably to go down when they went down, but they kept pretty much the squad
together.
They kept
the same team. I think that the thing about O'Neill was the contrast in when he first came and was doing stuff and it was working, and then when it wasn't working and it hadn't been working for since the start of the season. I mean, that was saying, I think this is the, since in the 8 years since we've been back in the Premier League, this season has definitely been the worst, least enjoyable season. That one, for me, was the second worst.
It was, because it was pedestrian.
It was just awful. It was.
But even when you, sometimes you don't sack the manager, you know, everyone kind of puts it down to, you know, I remember interviewing Kevin Ball and him saying, when Reedy came in and kept us up with 7 games to go or whatever it was, I was like, do you think we would have gone down if he hadn't come in? He was like, no, because like the players had already made a decision. I mean, you can say this, you know, but they had a meeting, they said like, right, we really need to get our act together now. So like, if you're down in tools 1 week, like they did, like we've already discussed, when it comes to the business end of the season, we know that they're actually, the likes of Larson and O'Shea and Catamol are actually capable of, you know, playing well, going through a game without getting booked.
It's not
scoring goals.
When we talk about that, though, it's not acceptable, is it? I mean, it's not acceptable. Like we're talking before, I don't know if I've mentioned it on this or it was beforehand, but if Digger had the whole season with his percentages, I guess we would probably have 45 to 50 points over the course of 38 games. That's what this squad should be leveling at. 45 to 50 points with the players that they've got at the ability. And we've seen it far too many times before. I know we said after the Palace game, said if we stay up, I wouldn't give any credit to the players. I'm still not willing to do that because they've got us into a situation. They can't keep on. They can't all of a sudden pull the shorts up in the quite well. I wouldn't put Catagall in that category. He's got shorts up quite literally all season, but. They can't just do it. They can't. It's not acceptable. They can't go and take all the plaudits. They don't. I don't think they deserve the plaudits that they get for keeping us up every season, because that's not acceptable.
There is a strong argument that because they're just not good enough. They're not good enough, and that's why they're in this situation every season.
I don't think it is that.
But
though,
I don't think you can necessarily. I think there's an element as well. You've got to look back and say, well, why weren't they playing under Gus Poyet? Why wasn't he getting the same level of commitment out of the players?
We've seen
that
it under
got
him
in 9 games.
But he got that, and O'Neill got that. I think it's a short-term thing, though.
The players have just clearly lost the confidence in Poyet, as fans had started to go, I guess. So they are human beings at the end of the day. So if they're going out in the field and they're not really clear on what on.
But I think it's going back to it was the system rather than the players, because if you go back to the early part of the season, take the 8-0 out of it, all those draws were saying they weren't far away, and we knew that the problem was goal scoring. You know, they didn't seem to be conceding goals, but they couldn't score goals. So if Gus could have found a way, and he knew, and I think that's why the Defoe signing came in January, in a sort of panic knee-jerk reaction, because he knew he was a striker away from that system working for him.
That's why he was playing so negatively.
Which is why he was playing
the ball. And he's like, he knew how to play like that until Christmas, didn't he?
And I think Gareth made the point, I think before we came on, saying that the 8-0 in a way set him back. I think it scared him to death because
that destroyed his sort of theory.
So he was going to play it cautiously, but it was always trying to find the system, trying to find the player up front.
I mean, I feel as if you look at the squad this year, for me, our best three players last year were Barini, Keane, Alonso, and then we lost them. We didn't replace them with anyone who's performed. Rodwell, Alvarez, you know, the
Gus's problem was he was chasing Barini. You know, that he took his eye off the ball.
So we were bottom, like, pretty much all of last season or there or thereabouts. So I think with the squad that we've got, we've actually done really well to stay up.
I think Gus as well lost a bit of heart because he couldn't get Barini and he didn't get Alonso when he thought he had both of them in the bag. I think that knocked him back as well.
Some questions from our listeners now. Lee Barker wants to know what people think about Dick Advocaat. Should he not accept the offer? Anybody got any suggestions? It's a tricky one, isn't it?
It is a tricky one.
Because we see him, we're looking for experience now, but who? Allardyce, you wouldn't have thought he was going to come and work under an aggressive director of football.
Well, I don't think he is, full stop. No. And I think if one comes, the other goes, and you know, and the one who's got to make the appointment is the one that would have to go. He's not going to, it's like, you know, don't vote for Christmas, do they?
On the other hand, if you get to a situation where Allardyce hasn't got a job and it's, you know, early July, he might think, well, I'll come. But I agree.
You'd like to think they'd hope they'd have something in place by early July. That'd be terrifying.
I mean, this is the thing now. They've got to make a decision if he says no quickly. And I think, one name that's obviously going to come in the frame now is McLaren, because he's not at Derby, probably not going to go to Newcastle. And he's available. They will look at him. I think there's no doubt they will sound McLaren out.
Because he's worked in that role. Because as well he's worked. Before,
my, yeah. My main worry is that like who's actually going to make the decision if we don't get Advocaat? I think we know a bit about Advocaat now.
It's Lee Congan, isn't it? Short's already come out and said it's Lee. This is down to Lee Congan.
Like overall within the club, like obviously it is him, but who else is there that knows anything about football, like on the board?
It's all on Lee, isn't it?
Well, there isn't. It is on Lee Congan.
He's got to start background.
Making the decision. But it's interesting that we were all under the impression that the Dick Advocaat appointment was made by Lee Congerton, but in fact it came from Hans the Scout, who suggested Dick Advocaat because he played with him for Holland, and that was a bit of an off the wall suggestion at the time, but they looked at it seriously because Dick Advocaat wasn't working. He is an experienced name, and I think they hadn't even thought about approaching him because he was such a big name in world football that they were thinking, well, you know what, he's never going to say yes. And it was Hans that said, well, actually, I think you'll find for 9 games he will say yes.
It's a strange one with managers as well, though, isn't it? Because, like, if, like, Allardyce, Tony Pulis or Pardew got appointed to your club, people wouldn't be particularly, like, over the moon about it. But as they've all proved this year, you know, I think Pardew's kind of proved, you know, after he left, Newcastle fell apart with the same team, and he's done so well at Palace that a lot of the time you get names that you're not particularly excited about that don't excite the fans, you know, whereas someone who was like a great former player would like excite them, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they'd make a good manager.
I mean, Sam Allardyce, as much as it will people will balk at the thought of it because of the football he plays. If you take it in isolation, West Ham are in Europe this season from finishing mid-table.
Well, it doesn't look too bad this season.
It doesn't look too bad, does it?
Never been in trouble.
No, and so what Allardyce would almost certainly bring to the club is a mid-table Premier League finish. Is what the one thing, and I was interested in hearing that Everton fans are up in arms about Martinez because they finished their worst position for how many years, and they were getting sort of fidgety weeks ago, and now they feel that it's such a poor finish that Martinez should go. Well, Sunderland would give their right arm for a finish like Everton have had.
Well, they'll have Martinez if they don't want him.
Well, it's interesting. Probably,
I think he's too attacking for like a team with a weak squad.
We'll have to buy the... I mean, that's the thing. We'll have to buy...
I'm not convinced on Martinez at all, though.
I think whoever comes in,
I thought he got far too much many compliments for what he did at Wigan and essentially got them relegated. They were fighting
I agree with you on
the manager front. Michael Todd is saying that Dick Advocaat clearly gelled the team together and got them working hard, given 100%, which I think we all agree on. But he also says so did Martin O'Neill, De Canio and Gus Poyet at certain times. So would Advocaat be likely to keep that up?
Well, that's what I was going to say before, that this time last year we all thought Poyet was an amazing manager. This time this year we think that Advocaat's a great manager, you know, but we haven't seen any negatives with him. So it's so difficult to kind of...
I think the difference is that we all had a fear about Di Canio because all sorts of questions were being asked about him when he was appointed. I mean, at Swindon there were all sorts of stories about his volatility, and we knew as an individual he was quite volatile, and we knew the stories about him and the coaching staff and how sort of single-minded and egomaniac he is. And so those stories were out there. Gus Poyet saying there was always this talk that, you know, what happened at Brighton... Is there an element of the Di Canio about him? He is inexperienced. But the one thing about Dick Advocaat, I haven't heard anybody yet say, you know, these are the flaws with Advocaat. His record as a coach stands up to scrutiny. And, you know, what he's proved and what he's shown in the 9 games, that sort of the calmness he showed, the confidence he's exuded, his strategy in going forward seems to make sense.
He's been really professional, hasn't he?
Yeah, very.
Even the way that you can... Obviously, you don't know what's being said, but when he goes over and talks to like other managers before and after the game, just with that experience he's got, he's obviously very respectful and very...
I think there's a great deal of respect for him, yeah.
Well, the thing is, he's not a talker, is he? He doesn't come out and say this and that and the other.
Well, Like when he first came and you were reading his quotes, he was hardly saying anything, you know, compared to like the likes of Quinn and Poyet and De Canio, where you just go like, oh, how you doing? And then half an hour later, they're still talking.
I mean,
he's not a big talker, but if you talk to him, he will talk about tactics and football per se, but then as soon as you start to talk about an individual or something specific to the team, it's a one-word answer.
Yeah, when he first comes, somebody said, like, oh, so what do you think about Sunderland? And he was just like, he was like, well, it doesn't really matter. Like, this isn't anything to do, You know, he didn't go into any of the niceties, you know, typical kind of Dutch logic kind of.
But I think it says a lot about him that he's bought into it. In 9 games, he's suddenly becoming, you know, he became very emotional about the whole thought of having to leave Sunderland. So it says something about the football club.
Adam Crewe asks, Ancelotti, Klopp, or Nigel Clough?
Not Nigel Clough.
Yeah,
Klopp's got Newcastle, isn't he?
Klopp's learning Spanish, isn't he? I'm told.
Obviously,
isn't that the rumor?
I don't know.
He's gone where?
He's been learning Spanish.
Has he?
Apparently.
It's interesting. A few people asking about the centre forwards. Gareth's just scrolled away. Tweets. So can't.
Yeah, most people. It's a question. Well, the main questions have been, who would you get if it was an advocate? That was most of people's...
People seem to think that goals is an obvious problem.
Yeah, goals is a problem.
So what do we do next season? Even to the point where we could let the likes of Defoe leave if we have to bring in forwards who are maybe more suited to the modern game. We were speaking earlier on about Palace, weren't we, and the power and the pace, and more sides are going down that route now, and we don't have any of that, really.
Well, I don't think they're going to get rid of Defoe. Not from their own making. And Wickham, I think, is going to stay. I mean, there are flaws with Wickham, clearly. I mean, we've seen them all. I mean, there's a lot of criticism that you can make about Connor Wickham. But I think the other side of it is he's 22, he's just signed a long-term contract, and not just Dick Advocaat, you know, other coaches seem to see something in Wickham. I'm not sure what it is, but they all say that he's got something, so they're not going
to
get rid of him.
You have to credit him for his performances under Advocaat, I think, as well. I think he's been one of the... Him and Gomez, I think, have probably been the two best players under Advocaat.
Wickham,
I don't know about that with Wickham. I mean,
well, he knuckled
Arsenal,
down on the
Arsenal
left.
Away, he was a disgrace.
Yeah, he was poor.
But I think when he matures, and if Advocaat was here, he is capable of playing that central role where, you know, the ball's going to him and people are getting knocked down. I was talking to an Arsenal fan after the game where we stayed up, and he was saying, you know, you should give Wickham time. He said, you know, we had Niall Quinn here when he was that age, and he wasn't any good. And, you know, a lot of times centre-halves and centre-forwards take a long time to, you know, to learn the game, goalkeepers as well.
I mean, if he can find an appetite, I think, for the game as well. I think that's something at the minute that Wickham lacks.
He's got to look like he's
lost,
hasn't he?
I think as well with Wickham, he's got to decide, or somebody's got to decide what kind of player he is. You know, is he someone who plays off the front? Is he forward? Does he play from wide?
We've played so many different
formations. Exactly.
Yeah, you know,
so
what I mean?
if he is going to say, well, listen, I want to be the centre forward, then
he wants to be that. He wants to be a centre forward in the old fashioned.
I think he'd be better off playing from wide in a 4-3-3.
But personally,
you'd almost feel like you need somebody who's good in that position now to come in, so you could learn from them.
I think if Advocaat stays, you could argue that Wickham's probably the only striker that we should keep.
I think he probably will. I think he will
be. Because Defoe's no good out wide. He's not like athletic or in terms of like his engine
he's
or like
probably,
physical
he's
enough.
Take one for the team at the minute.
You've got to credit him for that. Yeah. I know we've criticised him at times on here, and we've criticised the signing of him, not him as a player or a person. I mean, that's just a situation you find yourself in.
But he's not going to do it week in, week out, is he? You know what I mean? He's like, oh, there's 5 games to go, I'll do a job here. But there's certain games when he's looked up absolutely exhausted and he's used to kind of like feeding off someone or playing centrally. Obviously, Fletcher, I think we all know enough about Fletcher. I think it's time for him to move on. You know, Danny Graham, he obviously had a bit of a sort of like renaissance at Everton and eventually scored a goal. But I think, again, you know, he's not good enough to play week in, week out in the Premiership. There's a lot of average sort of, you know. But you can always clear the deadwood. People were saying we should have got rid of Larson and Catamol and O'Shea 4 years ago. But, like, collectively, those three, you know, I think have been some of our best players this year.
Mm. The centre-half partner for O'Shea is going to be important as well.
At least two. I think that I'm pretty certain we're going to see Coates here again next season.
Really?
I think the main. I think the partnership will be, what they'd look to do is put O'Shea and Coates as the first choice partnership, and then you're looking for two others to come in as cover.
I think they need to spend some money on a quality young centre-half. I think that's what they need, to find one from somewhere and bring him in, and I think that should be where they spend a large section of the money. Yeah, bring Reberge back, get him in.
Valentin, come back.
I think the thing with Coates is that He had to be given a run in the team as well, because he was coming back from a major injury, and then obviously he came in for that Man City game, which was just a nightmare, you know, Man City at home, where he was just skinned.
He had a bad game, didn't he?
And then, but he had to be you know, we were saying before about bringing people in and just giving them a run in the team, but it's difficult when you're up against it all the time. But now he has had a run in the team. I think he's been really good.
Well, I think the three games to me that really stood out was when he came in at Newcastle last minute and actually had a good game. And then Arsenal and Chelsea. I think you saw what sort of player Coates can be. I mean, his heart and soul. I mean, you can't question his commitment when he's in there. I mean, some of the last ditch tackles and some of his, even his ball play is actually not bad. I don't think, you know,
still a massive lack of pace by having O'Shea and Coates as like the main, is the main partnership. And like, if teams play to our weaknesses, like Palace did, then that's easily exposed.
He's
got
a Scottish father, and you can kind of tell by the way he plays, can't you? Because
he's not very good for the Emirates.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. He isn't this sort of cultured defender that we perhaps thought he might have been when Poyet signed him, because the football Poyet liked to play, and that's something we've said, that this manager and this style of football suits him, because he can just go out and defend first and foremost, no nonsense. He likes getting in the way of things, you know, like Jamie Carragher used to, and I think this manager gives him a little bit more license to do it.
I think some afternoons it's Seb Coates, other afternoons it's Sebastian Coates.
Coatesy. We've said all along it should be Coates.
He did say it. I asked him, is it Coates or Coates? He said, look, my father's Scottish, it is Coates, but in Uruguay I prefer Coates. So call me Coates. But then Dick Advocaat the other week referred to him as Coates, and then Chris Young on the Sunderland Echo said, well, what about Coates? And he went, who? And so Chris went, Coates? Oh, yeah, Coates. Right,
okay. Fair enough.
I think that's us done now for the summer.
Shall we thank people? Who've got to thank? We haven't got a list prepared or anything, so
it's maybe best not to start naming people.
Sun FM for letting us use the studio, Sunderland University for their use of the facilities. I Love Supreme, obviously, Sunderland Echo, I think. All the people who came on the show for free, everyone does it, like Nick, obviously, that's why he's only been on once, because we had some contractual arguments.
We're still talking about those, aren't we?
Yeah, so...
I do want to have to make a decision by Thursday or something.
So everyone who came on, everyone who reads the website, everyone who listens, probably missed off some people who we should thank. So.
Well, that's why I said there was a danger.
So the football club, of course, who we've had competitions this year, and when we've asked them for tickets, there's absolutely no questions, and they always give us them, and then they even say, if you want some more, get back in
touch.
Don't
take them up on enough, to be honest.
We feel shan taking it off them, but
Well, look, we worked over last summer and did some pre-World Cup shows and stuff like that, and it was good. It was really fun, live radio and all that, but we want a break, don't we?
Aye, just relax.
You need a break after the weekend, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, he does.
That's the more
me, he does.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be back.
We'll not say anything about that, Nick. We'll not go down that road.
We should be back this next season, obviously, with this, and hopefully
we might do one.
Maybe
we sign some players
and obviously into
talk
the light
about how rubbish they're going to be and
into
stuff.
The light should be back as well. So there should be 2 weeks, but it'll be easier to do 2 weeks when you've had 3 or 4 months off.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so for the season, thanks for listening. Over and out.